Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Casso.
Hello.
Cole Hornaday.
Hey.
And, of course, Nicole Lamb.
Hi.
How is everybody this rainy evening?
Oh, it's
not wet.
Not wet. Yeah. And it's kind of charming to sit in here and hear the rain coming down and feel the warmth of friendship and geekery.
And surrounded by books.
And surrounded by books, talking about the things we love. It's nice in here.
It is.
And don't make me go outside.
It was actually...
Don't make me go outside.
Unseasonably warm today here
it
in
was,
Seattle.
It was, which is nice. Yeah. I'm not freezing my hands off.
I walk to work, I put my heavy jacket on, I go outside, I'm like, what am I wearing this for?
Get it off of me!
You gotta get your light hoodies going.
Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. All right.
He says with a light hoodie on.
And you know, when I stepped out and felt the warmth, I'm like, this does not bode well. What bad things happen when the temperature rises like this at this time of the year? Are we going to get floods? What's going to happen? Are we going to have electrical storms?
We are going to have
tornadoes. Yeah. You know, that's where my brain immediately went because global warming.
Yeah. Boy, it would be a great last stand if you were on the roof of your building and a tornado came. Speaking of last stands, everybody, that brings us to our first subject.
That's a Ben Lawrence segue.
All right, I want to know about one of the best last stands in comics. It's those moments when a character dies. They don't have to die permanently, but, you know, they you know, to the reader, they die, but with, you know, with style or with a greater purpose or... Mm-hmm. Give me some examples of those.
Go ahead.
The one that sticks out most in my mind is the death of the death of Jean Grey and the birth of Phoenix, and that was the John Byrne, Chris Claremont storyline from X-Men 101 to 108, and that's way back in the 70s. But these were like, you know, very influential time period for me reading comic books as a young person. So you know, Jean Grey. Dies when the spaceship crashes in the Hudson River, and she resurrects through the power of this alien crystal and is reborn as the Phoenix, who is this godlike being whose powers are, frankly, out of control. And she would go off at night, visit other planets, and consume them while all the other X-Men were asleep. And eventually, these other races hold a trial for her on the blue area of the moon, and they determined that, you know, she's got to be put to death because she can't control this power. Jean Grey, that persona is still a very loving, gentle person, but the Phoenix or the Dark Phoenix is out of control and she's got to go. And Jean knows this, and they pit her in, and she and the X-Men, they pit her against the Imperial Guard, the Shi'ar Imperial Guard. And there's a moment where Jean and Scott, Cyclops, are hiding in an alcove, and she pulls up some sand to create a barrier so they can't be seen, and basically confesses to him that, you know, I'm not going to survive this and I probably should not. And she awakens a dormant laser cannon that's from one of the older cultures that's on the moon and blasts herself into oblivion, commits suicide. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that that is not the original ending of the story. They were originally going to subject Jean Grey to basically a lobotomy to remove the Dark Phoenix evil from her consciousness and, you know, leave her a good person. Marvel and I think Chris Claremont. Chris, if you remember any of this.
Well, it was Shooter that was Shooter like, you're going to kill her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Claremont
didn't
want
to kill her.
Yeah. Claremont wanted to neuter her because that's what Claremont tends to like to do.
Yep. Because he hates women.
Yes. But Shooter was just like, no. We're going to kill the woman who murdered many millions of people,
destroyed entire worlds.
Yes. Yeah.
She's got like Galactus destroyed worlds or just like scraped them of all life forms, but the worlds are
no,
still
she
there.
Burned the worlds to cinders. Yeah. The whole Phoenix.
Aurora,
right, would consume these planets and destroy entire races within a blink of an eye. But Marvel being Marvel, after the series was over, they printed a special album with the alternate version. So you could pay your, and it wasn't cheap at the time. It was like $6 to get this perfect bound reprint of a comic book that you already paid for on the newsstand with the additional 5 or 6 pages of the alternate ending, which I ate like candy.
Of course,
as
that
a
was
kid.
Before like the that was like the DVD special features
Precisely.
Of the day.
Yeah, yeah. But I love them both. I love that era of the X-Men, and it is long gone. So that was one of my favorite Last Stands. And though it had two different versions, it still had an impact on me. Anybody else have any? I'll keep going.
Hmm? Want to go? Okay. I have a Marvel one and a DC one. The Marvel one is for the Executioner from the Thor comics. And Walt Simonson did a story. I forget the issue number, but the story I think was called like A Bat Out of Hell. And it featured like Ragnarok happened, but the heroes lived and saved everything. But Hela stole like a bunch of innocent souls and took them to the underworld. So Thor went on a suicide mission with a bunch of Asgardians, and they got like supplied by the U.S. military. And he had with him the Executioner, who, if you weren't familiar, was like an old Thor villain who always kind of went with the Enchantress and maybe some other female characters, and was usually manipulated. He wasn't like the brightest bulb. And they were running away with like the souls. They saved the souls from the underworld, but the endless legions of zombies were coming to kill them for Hela. And they had to cross a bridge, and the bridge had a name, say Gjallarhorn or something.
How do you spell that?
Yeah, and
it had umlauts in it.
Yeah, and Thor was gonna make a last stand because he was injured, and he's Thor. But then he got sucker punched by the Executioner. And some of the other Asgardians are like, oh, he's betrayed us. And he's like, oh, no, hold on. And he tells him, like, I'm a joke. Nobody respects me. And I'm always manipulated. And it breaks my soul every time these characters manipulate me. So let me do this one thing. And so he takes two of the machine guns that the military left him. And he holds the bridge. And he holds it against like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of zombies. And the end of the book has a very poetic ending where they talk about the hell has no heroes or legends. But if you ask anybody who is the, you know, who made Hela stop and like bow her head, they'll only mention the stand at Gjallarhorn or whatever. And it's very, very well done and emotional sequence for like a minor villain. Mm-hmm. So it was a redemption arc too. So mm-hmm. it's just like, that's a really good last stand. The DC one is for Batman in The Rock of Ages was an alternate future story where Darkseid took over the planet and enslaved the human race and murdered half of it. And he turned the moon into a zombie factory. And Batman basically confronts Darkseid, and Darkseid's like, nah, I'm not going to kill you because you're worthless. And Batman says, look up, and he blows up the moon. And Darkseid has like the saddest look ever. He's like, you blew up my moon. And then he just kind of kills Batman just for that, and Batman's kind of just got like a ha gotcha kind of last stand thing. So that I just always kind of like where Batman's just like, yeah, you might be a god, but I still screwed you over.
So. There were a lot of last stands in the 90s, and of course probably one of the most impactful was the death of Superman, which I really enjoyed that story. I followed it from beginning to end, and I totally got caught up in all the reign of the Superman and the pretenders to the throne. And it's one of the many reasons why I think that Batman versus Superman is such an awful piece of work, because they really snubbed that whole story.
The Doomsday story.
Yeah, the whole Doomsday story. But as a result of the success of that story, we had a lot of last stands and a lot of superheroes dying in battle. And one of them that is a questionable last stand of quality is the Batman Nightfall story, where Bane breaks Bruce Wayne's spine, paralyzes him, and then Azrael takes over the mantle of the Bat to protect Gotham City. But it's a pretty brutal storyline, and that one's a slow burn too, because Bane is not just a brute addicted to venom. He's also very analytical, and he has a whole plot of working of slowly breaking down the Batman, and then the climax because doesn't he release all of the bad guys from Arkham yeah. and gives them opportunity to
wear him down.
So he wears down Batman to a raw nub and then beats him physically and cracks his spine, paralyzes him, and it was in the shadow of the Doomsday story of Superman. It was sort of may have been regarded as a pathetic also-ran kind of story. But in and of itself, I thought it was a really solid and tragic Batman story, and I do remember getting quite a bit out of it and trying not to compare it to The Fall of Superman.
Cool.
Do you have any, Nicole? Any favorite last stands?
Nothing that, like, sticks in my mind, like stuff that comes kind of later. Like, when I was reading the Walking Dead stuff in trades, the governor and the last stand that happens there's a lot of pivotal characters that die there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was exactly like with Sile or for a larger purpose, but for the narrative and to keep the feeling of like really almost everyone except Rick is not safe. Is kind of like, I mean, ultimately it looks like Rick's always kind of safe, even though he's losing limbs. But like the loss of his wife and the loss of Tyrone or Tyrese, he was one of my favorite characters. And so those kind of things were really pivotal. And I remember when certain characters died that I just put the book down and was just like, yeah. And that's probably the most pivotal like deaths for me. Yeah.
Okay.
And superhero stuff, it just doesn't maybe hit me as much, or maybe I haven't read the ones, you know, that
part of its timing
impact.
Because some of the best ones happened before death became regular.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So yeah.
I have to admit, I did a little bit of cheating. I went and looked up Last Stands because I needed help with my memory. Okay. And one that I'd forgotten about that someone pointed out in one article was the death of Dan Turpin in the Superman animated series.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good one.
And the Superman animated series is actually kind of fallen into the shadow of the Batman
League.
Animated series. But it really, and Justice League, but the Superman animated series had a lot of great stuff, and it paid a lot of tremendous tribute to Jack Kirby characters.
Which era of Superman animated series are we talking about here?
We're 90s. Talking about post Batman animated, and it kind of overlapped with Justice League United.
So
it's early
90s. 90s.
It is the 90s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have them all if you want to borrow them.
Really, do you have the 40s era?
I do.
Superman?
I have the Fleischman ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think they're restored too.
Cool. So, all right. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's this great moment where in the animated series where Detective Dan Turpin, who was very clearly modeled after Jack Kirby in the animated series, he stands up to Darkseid, tells him basically to get off my planet. And Darkseid has enslaved Superman. And it is a great last stand, and Darkseid just, you know, we'll never agree on how to pronounce that guy's name. Darkseid blasts him, disintegrates him, and he never comes back in the series. He is gone for good, which really surprised me that, you know, we're going to have some Deus Ex where he comes back, and we never did. Mm-hmm. Dan was dead for good in the animated series.
His name was Dan Tierney?
Turpin. As
Turpin.
In the turtle.
Terrible Dan Turpin.
Yep. Dan Turpin.
That's,
and he was from from the New Gods. Was he in the New Gods series? Where was he?
I think he popped up there, but he was just a regular cop that was always in the
right.
Yeah, he was in during the New Gods stuff. I think he interacted with Orion a couple times.
Yeah.
But the last one I'll throw out that I hope is when they adapt the Infinity Gauntlet into the Infinity War, there's a sequence where the heroes fight Thanos, and he's got the power of a god, and he kills everybody. He just flats out, like, kills Iron Man and Spider-Man and a bunch of other people. The last one standing is Captain America, and he's just a guy with a shield. And Thanos just kind of looks at him, smiling, and Cap just kind of sternly walks over to him slowly, and he just kind of points his finger up, and he just says, like, as long as anybody's standing, you don't win. And Thanos goes for, like, a kill shot, and something interrupts him. But it's just basically this guy with no real power just standing up to him and saying, I don't like bullies, which is the Steve Rogers thing. So I hope they get that into the movie, just for the sake of every Cap movie does that no bully thing. And it's just like, that's kind of, like, end it on that note to get there, you know?
Cool.
So, yeah.
Alrighty. Well, thank you all. I'm sure we'll revisit this because there will always be good last stands. But now let's move on to another segment that we call Recommendation Corner. It had a lot of had some positive feedback, and so I want to revisit it. And so let's pretend. And when I say a lot, I mean it, like one person, Scott.
I really liked when you did that.
Exactly. So let's pretend that I'm coming into the store and I want to buy a Christmas gift for somebody, and I'm going to give you a pretty vague description of them, and I want you to recommend what kind of comics to buy for Christmas gifts for my friends. So the first one, this is for a 15-year-old boy. He's a student athlete and is super excited to get his driver's license next year. He's into science, especially robots, and wants to pursue a career in holograms, whatever that means. What can I buy for him?
Who is this person? No.
Actually, that's my nephew.
Oh, okay. I would recommend either maybe some Iron Man, like Invincible Iron Man. I like the Riri stories, and Atomic Robo.
Okay. Atomic Robo
is really great sci-fi. Mm-hmm.
I, of course, said Transformers, and maybe throw in Cyborg.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Cool. All right. I will pick those up. This next one is for a 40-year-old female, a career woman who's climbing the corporate ladder at her financial firm. She doesn't read much fiction, mostly trade journals and the occasional self-help book. She doesn't have many hobbies, but does enjoy having a glass of wine at the jazz club with her friends on a Friday night. What should I buy for my friend?
I thought about the book called The Life-Changing Manga of Tidying Up.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I also just thought biographies in general would be
absolutely
appealing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would try to dig into you and be just like any kind of, not genre, but just kind of like music or whatever. Because there's so many biographies now.
Carter Family, don't forget
this
song.
Carter Family by friend of the show and Eisner Award-winning cartoonist David Lasker.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, there was one, I forgot the name of the guy, but there was one biography that came out about the guy who designed most of the landmarks in New York, you know, Robert Moses or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's just like, there's one for anything. So I'm sure we could find her something.
Yeah,
well,
definitely.
I would like to stretch her boundaries a bit and recommend that she read Saga.
Okay.
You know, because anybody that goes to a jazz club and likes to sip wine loves their serialized stories.
Right.
Loves their soapy stories. And Saga is like that, but so much more intelligent than anything else you're going to find on the TV dial.
Awesome.
Network TV dial.
All right. Yeah.
If,
cool.
If she was at all interested in fiction, I would probably recommend Black Sad.
Okay. Yeah, but, Black Sad.
Yeah.
But,
I know Black Sad.
It's something that I feel like people who don't like comics might appreciate just because it's almost like part art book.
Right.
It's so
right.
beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Thanks. I will probably pick those up. This is for a female-identifying 23-year-old. She loves Batman and everything DC, but recently suffered a fire in her apartment and lost everything, including her comic collection. How do I get her back to collecting comics? What should I pick up for her?
So I'm kind of thinking that maybe she might be burnt out to the point where she's like, I had all these things. I don't want to have to hunt them again. Mm-hmm. So I would move in a forward direction, and I would maybe get her to get the Superman comics by Tomasi and Gleason.
Oh, yes.
Because they have Superman and his son has his friendship with Damian Wayne, and you get some Batman in there as well.
Okay.
So you kind of get it going. You get her introduced to something a little bit different, but that's related, and it's also just a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that point, hopefully she'll kind of want to go and try out some of the other side projects like Super Sons. And we can backtrack and get the Damian had his own Robin series.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Get her into the Red Hood and the Outlaws. I'll just let Leanne talk to her about that. you know, then slowly move backwards. And
okay.
Like, yeah, let's get her year one. Let's get her Dark Knight. Let's
exactly.
get her, yeah.
Yeah, because there's that thing where, you know, you've lost everything and you might say, well, I don't know if I want to recollect everything.
Exactly.
You know, maybe there's only a few that are really important to me. And that might be some of the pivotal Batman stories, like mentioned. Yeah, so.
All right. Just to clarify, even though I said the first one was based on my nephew, the rest of these are made up. Don't worry.
Oh, thank goodness.
I don't know anybody
man.
Who lost everything. All right. Although this next one is kind of my dad. For a 68-year-old male, Recently retired military man, read comics as a kid, but nothing past 1960. Hobbies include repairing whatever his wife tells him needs fixing, yelling at college football games, and mowing the lawn. What should I get my dad? It's not really my dad. It's my dad.
Subscription to Sports Illustrated. Yeah.
Well, I thought it might. If he liked any of the war comics of the Silver Age, then that'd be something that you could get for him. But if he didn't want to focus on war, there are some really great Silver Age collections, both DC and Marvel collect. And then there's also the things that like Mark Miller was doing, like Huck and Starlight, which might be kind of nice modern takes that have some classic themes to them that could also work.
You know, Dark Horse has done those really great reprints of the EC comics, like Two-Fisted Tales.
Yeah.
Which I just picked up a bunch of those from the library. I should be done researching our latest episode of The Panel Jumper because we're done shooting now, but gosh darn it, I can't. And they're really nice, glossy, big books. They're not cheap, but they're worth the price of the ticket. So, but they've reprinted almost all of the EC comics from that era. But the science fiction books, weird science, weird fantasy, whatever. But particularly Two-Fisted Tales. War comics with a moral scope on them.
Yeah, so I think it more depends on what he read, maybe, if he cares to keep to go back. Some people are like, no comics exist after this point, you know? Right. And some people are open to branching out. Right. Did you have some stuff, Chris?
Not specifically. I was having trouble with that one because because the only thing for me to really go on there was the military part.
Yeah.
And I don't want to assume that they want a military comic, comic. But I might recommend something like Will Eisner's Last Day in Vietnam, which is not really a war comic. It's just kind of like a diary or a memoir of different experiences that people had. And maybe just some of the other Will Eisner books, like A Contract with God or stuff like that.
Cool.
So,
alrighty. Maybe I will pick those up. This is for a non-binary 30-year-old. They work in healthcare. They like superhero movies and TV shows, but have never read a comic. They enjoy cooking for friends and selling their craft soaps on Etsy. What should I buy?
This is funny. I thought Doctor Strange the Oath, because Night Nurse is in that, and that's something written by Brian K. Vaughan.
And it's also just a really solid story, whether you're into Doctor Strange or not.
Yeah.
It's really good.
And then because of cooking with friends, I thought of things like Relish by Lucy Nisley, which is a food memoir. Which could be kind of fun. Even though it's not superhero, it might appeal to their other interests.
Okay.
I don't know about any soap comics. Fight Club?
Boom! Good one, Nicole.
On superhero stuff, I was thinking of aiming towards like Ms. Marvel or the current Mighty Thor stuff.
Okay.
Definitely the Thor stuff. That's
I thought the Thor stuff would be good. Yeah. I thought maybe also getting something like Kim and Kim. Mm-hmm. Could be fun, just for different representation.
Sci-fi bounty hunters in space, and there's a trans woman who's one of the lead. Yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Alrighty.
I'm sorry, sidebar. Did you keep following Alter?
Yeah. I'm a couple issues behind on that.
Okay.
Yeah, right. But I've been enjoying it.
Good.
There's some progress with the Alter's brother, which I think is really interesting.
Because that's the transgender superhero character. I read the first issue, and I would recommend it. I would like to read more of it, but it just occurred to me as, you know, you're probably following that book, and would you recommend that?
Yeah, I would recommend that for like an alternative superhero that has its own universe, has a different representation. There's somebody who has cerebral. Is it cerebral palsy?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the one that you're wheelchair bound? I don't know if I'm remembering that correctly.
I do believe so.
That's the main character's brother, and the main character it's a coming of age transition / superhero story.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe I'll pick those up. I'm buying a lot of comics this year.
So many.
Finally. Get them on Amazon Smile.
Yes. For a 7-year-old girl, she likes typically girly things, princesses, fairies, etc. But I get the sense it's only because her parents tell her that's what little girls should like. Mm-hmm. What can I get her to let her know it's okay to like boy things too?
This is where I shine. Shine like a star in the universe! Okay, sorry.
This one was pretty obvious to me, too.
Obviously, yeah. Well, what did you have first?
Princess.
Yeah, Princess. Princess, excellent. Is very much obvious. But I also thought Princess,
yeah.
Spira, which might be a little advanced for a seven-year-old, and Lumberjanes, because there's a lot of different types of girls who like different things.
Okay.
And it's not princesses, but it's girl-centric while still showing that you can be whoever you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Alrighty, well, thank you all. That is my shopping list for this Christmas. I don't really know any of these people. I know some of them. Okay, let's move on to Book Reported, everybody. And Cole Hornaday, let us start with you.
Great. Okay, well, I just want to get something off my chest, and I will do it as quickly as possible. But, you know, I was really excited by IDW's attempt at launching their version of Vertigo, of a Vertigo line, edited by Shelley Bond. So I picked up their Black Crown Quarterly. It's printed for number one, printed fall 2017. And the cover reads a compendium of all things comics, cool, and culture and cool. And I open it up, and essentially what it is are excerpts from their coming titles. There's maybe one story that is an ongoing story that will be featured in this quote-unquote quarterly, but everything else are just excerpts and brief, and I would call them trite interviews with the creators. This is a huge glossy compilation of stuff that any other publisher would have put out for free, and I paid $6.99 for it, and I am really grumpy about that.
Wow.
Because this is stuff that should be a freebie on the counter that you pick up at your local comic book store that encourages you to buy it. I got really skunked by this, and I will probably not buy any Black Crown titles because of this. I miss the Vertigo line for a lot of reasons. There are you can say a lot of crummy things about the 90s era comics, but Vertigo had some stuff that had a tremendous impact on me. Swamp Thing, Sandman, and Doom Patrol, Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol. I guess there was a little bit of me that was hoping that that's what I was going to find with this, and I don't think it's going to be there. And Miss Bond, you're not going to find me buying your books in the future because I felt really, really screwed over by this.
All right.
That's a lot of money to spend for something that should be sitting in the basket next to my toilet. All right.
I'm going to move on. Black Crown.
Nope. All right. I may give their titles a chance, but I'm going to have to get over my mad first. And you know how long it takes me to get over my mads. So, and moving on to my actual book report. So a couple of weeks ago, someone said to me, Cole, I'm thinking about doing a late night comedy series at one of our local theaters, something like they used to do back in the 90s. Oh, the 90s. And I said, wouldn't it be cool to do something, a theater series about paranormal investigators? Because there was something there was that kind of stuff that was out there in the pop ether before we had the Ghostbusters. There were things like this Scooby-Doo and Goober and the Ghost Chasers and the Funky Phantom. So we all kind of grew up with those things. So Ghostbusters was a logical answer to that. And I started looking into comic books currently being offered that kind of answer those feed that appetite, answer those questions. So I picked up Joshua Williamson and Gordon Zakuta's Ghosted. And this is basically like Ocean's 11 meets the house or the haunting of Hill House. And it's I picked up the first collection, which was printed in 2015. I think there have been like four or five collections since then, or volumes rather. The first one was printed in 2013 called Ghost Heist, where this wealthy businessman who collects paranormal articles gets this high roller scam artist or con artist out of jail and has him put together an ensemble of specialists to go into a haunted house and capture a ghost for the guy's collection. And it kind of turns into an Agatha Christie, 10 Little Indians kind of thing where everybody gets picked off. But I kind of enjoyed it. It wasn't bad. It just fell on a lot of tropes, and I realized that, you know, this is kind of a subgenre of fantasy horror storytelling of the 10 Little Indians kind of story going into the haunted house and who's going to survive. We've seen it a lot with, like, Shirley Jackson's Haunting of Hill House, Richard Matheson's Hell House, The Legend of Hell House, Rose Red, The Conjuring, even Poltergeist. We see a lot of that stuff. I will probably go on and read the other volumes eventually because I thought they were fun, but I'm kind of curious curious is like, how are we going to keep redoing this premise of, you know, a bunch of con artists and mediums and people with supernatural abilities dealing with solving supernatural situations for money. So did you ever read this series? Mm-hmm. You did. What'd you think of it?
It was fun. Yeah. I liked it. I liked that Ocean's 11 mix with the haunted house stuff. Mm-hmm. I never finished. So okay. I need to finish it.
So I think they're like, there's a total of 4 trade paperbacks. And the series wrapped up around 2015, I believe.
Sounds
so
about right.
I enjoyed it. I will pick up some more. I got it at the local public library. So I didn't feel as skunked as I did over Black Crown Quarterly.
Okay.
And that is me, and I am done. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Cole. Ghosted. Check it out. All right. Chris Cassell, what do you got for us?
New Image number 1 called Dark Fang by Miles Gunter and Kelsey Shannon. This was a lot of fun. So it starts off with there's a guy watching like a chat room where there's a naked lady that you give like tokens to, and he gets killed and eaten by a vampire. And the vampire sees this room and she's like, "How do I make money? How do I do this? I want this." And she ensnares a tech guy named Toby to become her minion. And he teaches her the way of chat rooms. And she's just like, I get none of the tokens I desire. So she uses her mental powers to take control over thousands of people to give her all the internet money. And then it starts revealing that, like, why she's or where she's come from. And when she was a young village girl turned by the local vampire, she broke free, killed the master, and then decided to live under the ocean because it's always dark there and she didn't need to breathe and there's plenty of things to eat. And her best friend was a great white shark because it was also always hungry. And so she lives under the ocean for who knows how many centuries until an oil spill kills her best friend. And now she's coming back to the surface world to kill and murder everybody for that.
I totally understand.
Yeah. And so it's basically just about this vampire trying to learn how to live in the modern world. And her Renfield is this guy named Toby, who, by the way, pissed her off and she ripped off his head, but then brought her back to life. So he's kind of a headless Toby who has like a scarf to keep his head in place. So it's definitely a comedy. It's got this very fluid animated art style, mm-hmm. and kind of tongue in cheek way of approaching everything. And it's just cute and well done. So, you know, for $3.99, new number 1, it's worth checking out.
Cool. Dark Fang. Thanks, Chris. And finally, Nicole, what do you want to tell us about?
This tome published by Roar Comics. We've talked about Lion Forge before. Roar is their imprint that seems to also be pulling in a lot of like European things and stuff. This book is called Lighter Than My Shadow. It's by Katie Green. Pretty sure she's Canadian. And it is a memoir about her struggle with anorexia. It is as big as My Favorite Thing is Monsters, if you are familiar with that, but it's $19. It's definitely not as dense. There's this really interesting, simplistic art style. And she describes from an early age of being a picky eater to then getting older and starting to find that she wants to create like control in her life, and she finds that through anorexia. And it's a very, very good read. I've been kind of on the memoir kick recently. This one I read all in one sitting because it was very compelling. The art style was very beautiful. And her depiction of how she dealt with things was really interesting. When she would start to have those negative thoughts and things that felt like they were closing in on her, it was like this black static that starts going over her head. But it is a difficult read, and so there are times where I just would pause and sigh because there's some things where you can see kind of where they're heading to. And so it can be very difficult. And if you guys don't mind, I'd like to read the introduction mm-hmm. that she
Go
had.
For
Dear reader, you're holding the book I wish I had been there for me. It exists because I wanted nobody else to feel as lost, confused, and alone as I felt. I wanted to be honest about how hard recovery is and how long it takes, at the same time proving that it is possible. In truth, I wished for an instruction manual, and that's what I hoped to provide. But as soon as my own recovery unfolded and took turns I never have anticipated, I learned why such a book could not exist. Getting better is so inherently personal, and everyone must choose it for themselves. Nonetheless, I hope that in sharing my experience, my choices, good and bad, that I might reach out to someone struggling on their own journey. This book is my promise that it can and does get better to others and to myself. It's very, very compelling. If you do like memoirs, or if you or someone you know is struggling with something like this, or even just, I think, struggling with recovery and addiction, because a lot of things, it's either to self-medicate or to try to find control or to try to find a way out of your current situation or your own personal thoughts. And I think that it's very relatable in that way. It's a very good book. I definitely recommend it. I think the only complaint that I would say is sometimes the art style is so simplistic that it's hard to differentiate between the characters, because it's like her and her school friends who are all ladies. So it's like, this one has curly hair and this one has straight hair. Oh, but this one has a pigtail, you know. But that was very minor, you know. Otherwise, it said this is a really good book.
That's a pretty hefty read session if you read that whole thing in one sitting.
Yeah, I just ignore my husband and read comics on my day off. I'm sorry, husband.
It's also a good illustration for people who think comics are just funny books about people who can fly.
Well, the other interesting thing is I read My Lesbian Experience with Loneliness, and both of them have a thread of they want to become illustrators, they want to be artists, but something's holding them back.
Yeah.
Either they're told, no, don't do that, just do this, or they're telling themselves, don't do that, just do this. This is the second book that has done that, so it also has that thread of just like, actually, just do your thing. Just go do your thing.
You do you.
You do you.
Okay. Lighter Than My Shadow by Katie Green. Thank you, Nicole. Well, that is Book Report, and that is our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, where you can see the latest episode of The Panel Jumper, episode or issue 006, EC Come, EC Go. It should be posted on the website by now, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email at perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. And this week, our questions come to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday, late on us.
Woo! So this particular quiz time is spun out of what I mentioned earlier about the possibility of telling a theatrical series or serial about paranormal investigators, and how, you know, the Ghostbusters weren't the first property to introduce us to that idea, and it was, you know, so I've been my mind has been spinning around this. So please join me for Give Him a Ghost of a Chance, a personal Perfect Bound podcast quiz time devoted to what? Paranormal investigators. So this is going to cover the spectrum of media, so hang on to your sheets. Filmmaker William Castle loved his theatrical gimmicks, i.e. wiring the auditorium seats for screenings of The Tingler, so they were essentially like giant joy buzzers. In Castle's paranormal tour de force, 13 Ghosts, the original released in 1960, viewers were asked to don special glasses to see or block out each ghost when they made their on-screen appearances. Do you know what that gimmick was called?
Ghost vision.
Sexual vision?
You're all close. It was called Illusiono, which is basically a stereoscopic 3D that meant if audiences looked through these colored, red-colored lenses, they could either amp up the appearance of the ghosts or block them out entirely. Because remember, the film was in black and white. Mm-hmm. So essentially, it was kind of a cheap gimmick, and it really didn't work. And when you watch the film on TV, you don't have your Illusiono glasses. It's kind of pointless. No. So anyway, moving on. This Stephen King homage to classic paranormal investigator tales like Hell House and the Haunting of Hill House was set in a very familiar city to all of us here sitting around this table.
Seattle.
Right. Rose Red. Sorry, I didn't put the title of the movie in there. Oh, I'm such a loser. Sorry. Yes, Rose Red was set in Seattle. It's 2002 ABC miniseries.
The we film, all just like blanked. We're like, what, yeah. What city
what are you
are
talking about?
Familiar?
How about if I read the question again with that?
Let's with just the start this podcast.
Title of the film in there. All right, forgive me. Rose Red, shot in Seattle. The film features several local actors, including local treasure Laura Kinney. I moved to Seattle the year they were shooting the film. I was walking up on Lower Queen Anne, and this gentleman who looked like Julian Sands walked by me. And I turned to the people walking with me, and I was like, that guy looked like Julian Sands. They're like, oh, now you're crazy. 2 days later, I'm on the monorail with Gene Ha and his wife, Lisa, and that same gentleman is sitting in the back of the monorail, and I look at Gene, I'm like, that's Julian Sands. He's like, why, yes. Yes, it is. Boom. My life is complete. And then a year later, the series is on TV. What series? Rose Red. Shot where?
Here it is.
Yay! Okay. In Peter Jackson's 1996 horror comedy, The Frighteners, Michael J. Fox plays Frank Bannister, a paranormal investigator who can actually see and communicate with dead spirits. Producer Robert Zemeckis initially considered Jackson's story treatment as a spinoff for this very popular HBO television series inspired by what famous EC comic book series from the 1950s?
Tales from the Crypt.
That's right. The Frighteners is supposed to be a spinoff movie from Tales from the Crypt.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. This occult detective created by William Hope Hodgson in 1910 was a precursor to weird fiction creations like H.P. Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard. Ever the skeptic, this character's debunking efforts are oftentimes inverted when the hauntings he investigates are proven to be authentic. Though his stories are long in the public domain, they are seldom out of print, and Alan Moore frequently made reference to this character in his ongoing series, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, particularly The Black Dossier. Do you remember the name of this character?
It's not Dr. Spectre.
Nope. Okay, Carnacki the Ghost Finder is William Hope Hodgson's Tales from the Cult Detective. Carnacki first appeared in a five-part series in The Idler in 1910. All told, there are only 9 Carnacki stories penned by Hodgson, published between 1910 and 1947. However, many fiction writers have told Carnacki stories, including Warren Ellis in his Gravel series from Avatar. So he pops up. Lastly, name this diminutive paranormal investigator and spiritual medium who pretty much stole the show by creeping us out far more than a clown under the bed or a child eating tree in Toby Hooper's film Poltergeist.
They're here. I don't remember her name, though.
No.
Remember her name, anybody? Tangina Behrens, played by the late Zelda Rubinstein, and made famous the line, "This house is clean." And that is quiz time. She creeped me out like
that. Oh, yeah, that lady.
I like her. I want to be friends with her.
She's in the sequel, too. It's on Comet right now.
She's my people.
Is she your people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Weird, creepy people.
You love that Comet TV channel, don't you, Cole?
It's a good channel,
I do
man.
Love that Comet TV.
There's surprising things that show up on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And cool. There's some awful things.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well, that is quiz time. Thank you, Cole.
You're
welcome. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.